Taking Stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.
This is Gavin McLaughlin with you on Taking Stock, and we're joined now by Graham Brownlow, Senior Lecturer in Economics at Queen's University Belfast. Graham, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
I want to start with Brexit, which obviously is a major issue, and you have this sort of position where Northern Ireland is half divorced from the UK in economic terms and half married to the EU. Is this going to work?
Well, it's going to make things tricky and complicated. I think what it suggests is that a lot of the talk at best of both worlds, I think, has been too optimistic because it underestimates the cost of adjustment and the complexities involved. It also suggests that the other extreme of the Brexiteers, that somehow miraculously it would bring down transaction costs and deregulation within the UK economy, has actually been shown to be also false. But I think actually the way things have transpired, I don't think really suggests that either extreme position has been correct. And I think things have turned out badly in many ways. But
it is early days, though. I mean, there is the potential that there could be some adjustment to it.
Oh, I think certainly there will be, but I mean, the adjustments are not costless and not instantaneous. The other thing to note, of course, is about how different the adjustments are going to be by sector. I think an awful lot of discussions before Brexit underestimated the extent to which different sectors tell different stories. And I think that the supply chain story of agri-food is not the supply chain story of, say, electronics or pharma. But I think you're right. There is complexity. Of course, we have to try and disentangle a lot of it from what with COVID as well, which is a further complexity. So far, it's certainly the protocol problems, etc., have had implications for the Northern Irish economy that I don't think have been necessarily favourable. But let's hope it does work out over time.
Yeah, and politically it's a big problem, of course, and we've seen some unrest on the streets. What's your assessment of how this has affected unionist perception of their place within the union? Is it sort of a short-term flare-up or is it something more serious?
Well, you know, I mean, speaking purely as an economist, I have no expertise as a political scientist. I mean, the point was in the negotiations of Brexit and since 2016, an awful lot of emphasis was understandably put on the border or lack of border on the island of Ireland. But I think people were rather too sanguine about the symbolism of the sea border. And this was alerted during the discussions at the time, but I don't think people picked up on it. Again, I think pragmatism, I think, will prevail, I hope. It's notable the Americans, when pressed upon the NI protocol, weren't coming out rowing in favour of it. They were very, very centrist on it and urging pragmatism. So I think we'll probably see some kind of movement. Also, you know, down the line, going back to the economics, there's the implication of the pharmaceutical transfers between GB and Northern Ireland that could be disrupted by the end of this year. Again, the judicial reviews that are been threatened at the minute can't help matters. So I think all in all, it's hard to disentangle the economics from the politics, but I mean, as far as I can say as an economist, certainly political instability can't be helpful for Northern Ireland or indeed Island of Ireland as a whole.
For sure. And if we leave aside recent events, I mean, Northern Ireland as a region of the UK hasn't prospered economically in recent decades. I mean, it's consistently one of the poorest regions of the UK in Northwest Europe. And it's actually fallen further behind the rest of the UK since the Good Friday Agreement, which, you know, I think a lot of people thought would bring an economic dividend. So what's the problem?
Well, I think it's a very mixed story. I don't necessarily think we should tell a simple story in which all is woe. It's actually, you know, Game of Thrones, etc., been filmed in Northern Ireland. Unemployment rate is, what, 3.6% at the minute? So it's, what, 2% below the Irish rate of unemployment. So, you know, the fact is that Northern Irish economy is very mixed. What you see is a structural and sub-regional issue, that there are parts of the Northern Irish economy where you could say, like, the high-end consulting, fintech, cybersecurity, things like that, and high-level public sector in Greater Belfast have been done reasonably well. The problem for a lot of Northern Ireland is that's very spatially concentrated in Greater Belfast. So in many ways, if we're actually thinking about the Northern Irish economy, perhaps it'd be more sensible to think about the Greater Belfast economy and the rest of Northern Ireland. In many ways, what you're looking at is sort of an island of high-value, high-skill, high-productivity jobs surrounded by hinterlands that have left those concentrations, which isn't too dissimilar from the southern economy of, you know, Greater Dublin having a far higher proportion of pharma, IT jobs, et cetera, high-level consulting jobs than would be the case outside of Greater Dublin. So I think we have to be careful about, you know, the very simplistic headline figures.
Because the stereotype, of course, is that the, you know, the public sector is what dominates. But clearly, as you've pointed out, you know, like everywhere, I suppose, there's differences that crop up between different regions. Now, the Troubles, that obviously had a big impact on the economy. But you say actually there were issues that were starting to crop up even before that.
I was really going to go back. I mean, the point about the public sector currently, of course, is an issue about the public sector is a compositional one, and that takes into the troubles and the consequences. The problem before the troubles was a problem of failure to adjust the economy. So what you had was the old staples of shipbuilding, linen, etc., tobacco, rope, all these other, you know, great old staples of the Ulster economy. These were industries in decline. And of course, what you needed was an adjustment to new industry. And, you know, there was the attempt of new industry, inward investment. I mean, Northern Ireland pioneered inward investment long before the South, back in the 50s, people write about this. But it didn't do it as successfully as it should have done for a variety of reasons. And what you're left with is an economy where you have the decline of the old, which is to be expected. But you don't have the rise of the new, which is what you need to offset the decline of the old. And that leaves the economy fragile. And that ultimately means that even before the troubles, you have a fragile base that's made more fragile, of course, by violence, which turns off the tap of high quality inward investment, tourism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, new business creation. And of course, the other thing, going back to the public sector point, is there's a massive upward spike in the public sector during the troubles. And it's not just the level
and
of the
why was that,
sector.
Graham?
Well, it's because of a number of things. The easiest way to understand it is what I've termed, or what was termed at the time, the interrelated strategy, that essentially that you had political, military, and economic tools were used to stabilise the Northern Irish economy, and that there was a willingness to make trade-offs in terms of economic efficiency. And so what you ended up with was the use of stimulus to stabilise levels of output. You also had a backlog of underinvestment of public housing, an underinvestment in a lot of public infrastructure, a lot of inequity that obviously was the source of civil rights, etc. And so you had the Northern Ireland Housing Executive, and you had security expenditures. You ended up with not just a very high level of public spending by 1998 for the, you know, Good Friday Agreement, but the composition was rather odd, that it was skewed in favour of public housing, security, etc.
Yeah, and it's still a hangover to this day, I think it's fair to say.
Well, that's exactly the point I was going to make, that what is odd at first sight, okay, what is odd at first sight is the law of the adjustments, a peace dividend, that you would have expected to see after 1998 hasn't happened. But you see the continuing, on some figures, the Northern Ireland economy more dependent on public spending than it was during the Troubles. Certainly if you look at John Fitzgerald's and Edgar Muggerath's piece, that indicates that. But that's largely because of the composition of the public spending. The composition of the public spending skewed towards social protection, i.e. welfare. The legacy of housing expenditures and the legacy of security expenditures. So you end up with not just a rather large public sector, but a public sector that's skewed in a way that is a legacy of that political instability. So there hasn't been a quote-unquote peace dividend in that regard. But, you know, all the evidence from economics suggests that it's not necessarily the share of government spending in income that you really have to focus on. It's the composition of the government spending in income you have to think a bit about.
Our guest here on News Talk is Graham Brownlow, Senior Lecturer in Economics at Queen's University Belfast. And Graham, I want to get on to this issue of a united Ireland, because there's a lot of talk about it now. And I suppose in the Republic, one of the key things that comes up is this issue of the subvention. And this basically is the difference between the amount of revenue that's raised by the UK government in Northern Ireland and the amount the UK government spends there. And the reality, as we know, is a lot more is spent there than is raised. And people often say, well, this is how much cost the Republic would have to absorb in the event of a united Ireland. First of all, what is the figure, Graham? How much is being transferred in?
OK, well, there are different arguments about what the exact figure is. But I think the important thing to understand is the per capita figure is probably about £5,000 per head for people in Northern Ireland. That's the sort of the accounting figure. I think the key point about the subvention is it's often misunderstood in public discussion what it is and what it isn't. The idea of a subvention or a fiscal transfer, a fiscal co-insurance, or risk pooling, it goes under various names, is the idea that in any multi-region country, you have a notional idea of the balance of tax and revenue from that region. And thus, the higher the income of that region, the more tax revenue it pays into the common pool, and the less public spend it takes out of the common pool, at its most simple. Okay, so the idea would be that a very rich region would put in a lot more public spending, tax revenue it puts in than public spend it takes out. And a very poor region would take out a lot more it puts in. And the average region would put in and get out exactly the same level of money. I mean, that's the underlying model. And so from that point of view, given that Northern Ireland's income is lower than the UK average, you could argue it's one of the three lowest, along with the northeast of England and Wales, it's only to be expected that it's taking out more than it's putting in. You know, so your per capita income, your per capita figure must be higher than the UK average, which it is. But one of the peculiarities of the real world UK figure is if you break the UK into 12 regions, okay, only three regions are actually putting in more than they're taking out. The UK, as an economy of regions, is an incredibly unequal economy.
We kind of touched on this earlier when you were talking about, you know, the Belfast economy versus the rest of Northern Ireland. I thought every country has an element of this involved.
If you did that for Ireland, you would find certainly Dublin, Greater Dublin, would be very much different than the more rural western part of Ireland. And if you did it even within Dublin, you'd find parts of South Dublin putting in a lot more than they're taking out than parts of, say, North Dublin.
So it's a fairly kind of standard situation. But there are even more things to bear in mind about this. People talk about the figure, say it's £10 billion or whatever I think is the latest figure we had. Mm-hmm. The single largest element of that in 2019 was £3.4 billion in pension payments paid by the British state. Mm-hmm. to pensioners in Northern Ireland. But there is a question about those, you know, whether those obligations would fall to the Irish government to fulfil in the event of a united Ireland. Because, you know, if you take what Sinn Féin says, for example, they say people in Northern Ireland would have accumulated rights from their national insurance payments, which would mean basically the UK would still have to pay these pensions even if there was a united Ireland.
That may or may not be the case. Unfortunately, the problem with that is that takes out of the area of economics proper and into future hypothetical negotiations. I mean, what we can say is that there are all sorts of expenditures that may occur under United Ireland that wouldn't occur currently. and so I think that...
What kind of expenditures do you mean?
Well, there's all sorts of social protection expenditures, for example. You know, all sorts of scenarios could emerge. And all sorts of scenarios would occur, of course. Culturally, you'd want to protect certain identities. And this, I mean, if you know, I've done historical work on home rule. And these arguments go back 100 years. You know, people forget that the unionists argued about the public provision of railways. They forget about workers' compensation, old age pensions, etc. All of these additional expenditures that were made in the UK the first 10, 20 years of the 20th century were all used by unionists to argue that these were things that would be lost in the event of Irish unity. And as things transpired, you know, public spending was, there was a type of austerity that was imposed in the early decades of Irish independence. So a lot of the political economy, if you want to make it that way, in the first decades of the 20th century, was a discussion about, you're asking that unionist majority not only to give up their citizenship in the UK, but you were asking them in return to pay for the privilege in terms of higher taxes and or lower standards of public services for the privilege.
Yeah, you're bringing me back to my school history lessons about Ernest Blythe. I think it's the first time he's come into my head for a while. He was behind a lot of that austerity, of course. The point about, you know, the economic cost of the unions is an interesting one. And if we look recently at today, you know, we can see almost 2/3 of Northern Irish people, for example, would be uncomfortable transferring to the Republic's health system. So that's just one of these areas maybe where, you know, there might be some extra costs. But there would be some benefits as well, wouldn't there? You know, economies of scale from less duplication of resources, certainly in the public sector, you could see scope there. And also it would be easier to coordinate infrastructure spending.
Well, I mean, people talk about duplication of public expenditure. I mean, I can understand. Let's think about it like a fire service. One could say avoiding the duplication of the administration of a fire service, perhaps. But you're not going to have any less firefighters, I would hope. You know, so and you know, where do you make the economies in terms of reducing the administration of the fire service? That's just, you know, one example.
Yeah, so maybe cutting a load of jobs wouldn't be the best in terms of fostering unity in the event of this new state.
Yeah, I mean, we're really in the realms of speculation. That's part of the reason, as an economist, I find a little bit uncomfortable talking about this stuff. But it strikes me as implausible for people to argue that public expenditures in some areas would not have to actually increase. Because you would have to figure that you're asking people to forego stuff that they value, and of course we're speculating on a scenario where there's no shift in demography, and there's no shift in the subvention. So so we're saying that the population stays exactly the same in terms of composition. If people, however, felt uncomfortable. And those people are of working age, i.e. paying money in rather than taking money out, rather than older people or younger or the very young, then those people leave. So you end up with your composition of your public finances look a lot worse. So I think there's an awful lot of scenarios. But one of my problems with a lot of this discussion as an economist is that people make it based upon a scenario. Some people politically have an incentive to say that scenario is the best case scenario in which it's all peaceful and in which they assume away any migration, et cetera, et cetera. The point is, you can easily look at other scenarios which are not so benign. You know, as I, you know, as I've discussed in my work on the legacy of the troubles, I mean, there's all sorts of issues about organised crime and paramilitarism, etc. None of that, I think. You know, just speaking as an economist, I think just assume away those things.
Yeah,
doesn't strike me as a very plausible, sensible way of going about it. You know, you don't want to play tennis in the net down.
Yeah, I mean,
I think what I'm trying to say.
Do you think this whole debate around the subvention is a bit of a red herring? Because you alluded to it there earlier that a lot of it, you know, there'd be negotiations around things like pension and you know, the outcome would determine what the cost was. But it's these longer term, broader issues maybe is what we should be spending more time talking about.
I think that the focus should not be on the subvention, to be honest, in thinking about the economy. The subvention in many ways occurs as a consequence of the poor productivity of the Northern Ireland economy. I now am a member of the Northern Productivity Forum at Queen's, and I think far more attention and focus should be put on curing that problem, because that will transform public finances. If one looks at the turnaround of Ireland, you know, that turnaround of Ireland occurs very late in the day. You know, the Kevin O'Rourke work, you know, talking about the role of the EU in transforming Ireland's economy. You know, and those things go right. And of course, things then go wrong. But the things that go right because the Irish economy is transformed into an economy less reliant on a slow-growing British economy, less reliant on inefficient small farms. You know, all the transitions that occurred. But those things were slow burns. You know, the corporation tax reductions occurred in the 1950s. Don't really kick in until maybe the 80s. Some people would say even the 1990s. You know, so these things are slow burns. There's a difference between people's political preference for how they would like the world to be and how economic processes actually work themselves out. You know, people would prefer, or would have preferred, you know, a soft landing in the housing markets at a time, but what they got was a hard landing. And I would just caution people against, just because they prefer the world to be in a certain form, to think that that's the way the world will turn out, because I think, again, there will be various scenarios that could transpire, and you have to be very careful.
Okay, well, on that note of caution, we leave it there. Always useful to be prudent when it comes to economics. Thanks very much for that, Graham. That's Graham Brownlow, Senior Lecturer in Economics at Queen's University, Belfast. Thanks very much for being with us, Graham.
Thanks for the invitation.
Taking stock on Newstalk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.